skies for WPFW in Washington and WBAI New York. I'm Chris Spangert-Drowns. Thanks for listening.
Good afternoon, everybody. This is Zain El-Amin with the Shai Unanna Show. And today's show is going to be focusing on Lebanon and sort of getting your eyes on Lebanon. All eyes are on Lebanon right now because there's going to be a war that seems inevitable. The U.S. has basically given green lit, like they did with everything in terms of the massacring of Arabs in the 20th century, in the 21st century, and most recently the massacring of Palestinians. The racism that is existing in the United States right now is not actually anti-Semitism. It is a different kind of anti-Semitism because Arabs are Semitic people. And the racism is exemplified in the recent attack on Palestinian children that were swimming in a swimming pool in Texas, where a woman came and asked their hijab-donning mother that where she's from, and then proceeded to try to drown her children in a pool before people in that community stopped her from drowning the children. This woman, of course, has been arrested, but it just shows you that time after time we get this the violence against Muslims and Palestinians as Islamophobia spreads. But on the other side, Zionists are trying to weaponize anti-Semitism when they're really not following Judaic traditions. A recent ex-Shin Bet Secret Service, basically, person had stated, warning that Israel had lost its humanity. Yes, it's coming from the Israeli deep state that's warning that Israel has long, not just recently, not since October 7th, but since 1967, this person said that they've been warning about the loss of humanity, which is really apparent to the world right now. Of course, our government is right now being held hostage, and you can see it in the primaries. And again, another way it manifested itself yesterday is where you have Jamal Bowman, an African-American, running for Congress and representing a district that needs social services, that needs better education, that needs investments in life, not death. And so the Israeli lobby, AIPAC, as you might have heard, put something close to $24 million into his opponent, who they brought out of inaction to run against this Jamal Bowman, who's prioritizing his community over war and genocide. And sure enough, the Zionist handpicked person that was funded by AIPAC won and will not look after the interest of his people. He will work on legislation to censor free speech and to do whatever it takes to comply with the whims, the violent whims of his master, the Israeli state and AIPAC. So that's where we are. There's nothing that exemplifies the hijacking of our government more than what happened yesterday in the primary elections. And it's really interesting that another thing that it showed us, what happened yesterday, what it showed us is that it doesn't matter what what you stand for, that as long as you stand against Israel, Democrats, the Democratic Party establishment, will unite with MAGA Republicans, Republican billionaires, to fund the hell out of an opponent that is standing for Israel, because their priority is the Zionist state and not the people of the United States. And this won't stand for long, because there is going to be resistance. There's a lull right now in resistance, but I promise you, there's going to be an uptick in the resistance as these things become more clear. Lastly, again, the show today is about Lebanon, and I have two things to share with you. The first one will be the Gaza war sitrep on date 263, is Israel cracking. And this is, since we're focusing on Lebanon, and I want eyes to be on Lebanon right now, the Anti-Empire Project put out this 33-minute piece, this half-hour piece, on with the question, is Israel cracking? And that'll be followed by a short clip that I felt it was important to share from Democracy Now, that is featuring Rami Khoury, who Amy Goodman has interviewed. Rami Khoury has been one of the best insightful commentators, especially when it came to the Israeli war on Lebanon. So let's start with is Israel cracking, from the Anti-Empire Project.
All right, I'm back. Gaza war, day 263. No end in sight. Tonight's question is, will they or won't they? And as I think you know, the answer is that they will. So we're talking about when the all-out war between Hezbollah and Israel will begin. I think it'll be sooner rather than later. I watched Elijah Magnier on Rania Kallik's excellent show, Dispatches, Breakthrough News, and he broke down all the reasons why it would be completely irrational for Israel to attack Lebanon right now. And you've heard all of them. You've heard the fact they're unable to defeat Hamas. Hezbollah is exponentially more powerful, more capable of delivering more damage to Israeli society. Nasrallah for years has explained all of the things that will be targeted in the event of an all-out war: the electricity grid, power, water, all the military facilities, the missile launching sites, the airports, all the infrastructure is up for grabs. Hezbollah has said they will hit whatever they want. He said there will be, Nasrallah in his most recent speech said that there will be no ceiling. He said that before. He said it in his latest speech. Irrational, yeah. But that, I have also been saying on this channel, that trying to understand Israel's behavior through military rationality is not how you can understand Israel's behavior. Ordinary strategic calculation is actually a minority view, perhaps, in the West, and certainly among the neoconservative or Zionist worldview. Ordinary strategic calculation is not how they see the world. They see the world in terms of will, racial superiority, and will. They will dominate the region through the force of their will, or they will die trying. People have often quoted Hitler at the end of World War II, and where he said, he expressed how disappointed he was with the German people and how they failed They failed him. In his view, the German people had failed him because they lacked the will to follow through with the program that that his party was trying to enact in the world. And that is the worldview from which the current Israeli decision makers derive their understanding of the world. And I am sure that the Israeli elites are looking at the human material, as they once referred to the Jewish population, the early Zionists referred to the Jewish population as the human material, and they found it disappointing. And I'm sure that is the same kind of conclusion that the Israelis are coming to now, is that they will either succeed based on their will, or they will have been failed by others other than themselves, because the people making the decisions are infallible in their own eyes. I can do a lot of reporting from the fronts, and I will resume that in future sit reps. There's so much to report. We've seen new massacres over these weeks, murders of Ismail Haniyeh, the political leader of Hamas. More of his family members were murdered by Israel. He's made another dignified statement like he did last time. We see the West Bank is being invaded again, another one, set of raids in Qalqilya and Jenin. There's fighting in North Gaza and Beit Lahia. Ansarallah from Yemen has hit an Israeli ship and a U.S. Navy ship. The U.S. Navy versus Ansarallah battle continues. The U.S. withdrew one of their carriers, but then they put another carrier back. So the Ansarallah said something like that. They said, the first round goes to us, but we're getting ready for the next round. So the next round of that naval war is on, and it's happening now. But that's a really short version of the report. I'll resume my normal reporting from the fronts probably in the next video tomorrow or the day after at some point. But today I kind of want to talk about the cracks that are forming in Israeli society, the pressure cooker that the Israeli elites are in right now. And I watched, did you guys watch the drone footage? Did you guys watch the drone footage Hezbollah released, the Hoopoe Bird Part 1. I watched it when it came out last week or whenever it was, but yeah, I guess it was about a week ago. But I didn't really understand quite the import of it until I watched the translated version. So Laith Maruf, Free Palestine TV, they shared a translated version of this video. And when you watch, if you're an English reader, I can read Arabic letters, I know some Arabic words, but I can't just follow, like, hopefully I will be able to, but I can't just read and see what they're doing. But as an English speaker, an English reader, watching this with the English, where the level of detail of what they're pointing out and the targets and how they're showing exactly what these facilities are and how they know exactly what these facilities are and how they've built this target bank. It's if you were the Israeli military, this would be a terrifying video, a terrifying video for them. And they're showing the military industry, Iron Dome, David Sling batteries, military bases. It's a really, I would highly recommend that you watch the whole thing. It's on Free Palestine TV, Twitter. I retweeted it. Take a look at it. Watch the whole thing. It's 9 minutes. Watch it and imagine what you would feel if you were an Israeli military planner who was raised and marinated and stewed in an atmosphere of complete domination and superiority, and the belief in your own superiority over these undermensch, these under people. And imagine that view that you're used to putting out there, the view that you're used to having, that aerial God's eye view of what you're going to destroy from the air, and having the facilities you built in the occupied lands, the military facilities you've constructed, and having that view being broadcast back to you. And maybe it was intended as a warning by Hezbollah when they published that, or maybe it was precisely intended as a provocation. And I think I could go either way, but it was certainly taken as a provocation. So it drove Israelis into another kind of level of, I don't know what to call it, irrationality. They said, this means we have to go to war. The fact that they can do this means we have to go to war. We have to destroy them once and for all. So the thing is, there's that drone footage, and then there's Nasrallah's speech. And Nasrallah's last speech, I talked about it in my mini sit reps, if you saw on Instagram or on my TikTok. I don't really have much presence on either one of those platforms, but I did during my travels. I tried to make a few mini sit reps from the road because I knew I couldn't do a proper one until now. And the thing is, I think I said this in the mini sit rep, but there's not a feeling. If you watch Nasrallah's last speech, it's not a last warning. It's not a don't do this, Israel, or else. That's not the tone. The tone is not the tone of someone trying to talk them out of it. The tone is more like, I read it more as like a, this is the last time you're going to hear from me until the war. The next time you hear from me, we will be fighting. And it was also an explanation. Nasrallah's speeches have all had this element of explaining to the people in Lebanon the concept that has come up. It's been put in many different terms, but it's the concept. The one way that he put it is the price of resistance versus the price of surrender. And he's always been putting that theme that the price of surrender is much higher than the price of resistance. And the last speech was an explanation to Lebanon to say, we tried, but we are not getting out of this without a war. We've tried hard to avoid a war, which will end up with massive civilian suffering, the destruction of civilian targets all over Lebanon, the destruction of Beirut. Many pro-Israel psychopaths have been showing Beirut and saying this is the before picture, as if Israel is immune from retaliation, which it's not. But they don't understand that, and that's another element of the pressure. I didn't cover Nasrallah's discussion of Cyprus in my mini sit reps. So it's evident from the way Nasrallah talked about Cyprus that Israel had planned to use Cyprus and plans. Israel plans to use Cyprus as its strategic depth. So they're aware on some level, military planners, the Americans, the Israelis are aware that Hezbollah is capable of destroying their airfields, their radars, making it very difficult for the spectacular Israeli Air Force to do their thing. And that once if the Israeli Air Force can't do their thing, they're not the Israeli army. They're not the Israeli military is not the Israeli military if its Air Force is not working. So their idea was, we'll use Cyprus, we'll use their airports, and we'll attack a joint, a pincer movement or some clever strategy where they're not expecting us to attack from the sea, and we'll use Marines and we'll attack from Cyprus and from northern Israel. Maybe they were planning something like that. And Nasrallah let Cyprus know that if Cyprus is used, it'll be treated no differently from any other Israeli base. It won't have any protected status because it's not technically Israel. If it allows Israel to use its base, it'll be treated just like Israel is by Hezbollah. So that probably has caused some delays, some revisions of plans. They're probably drawing up a new plan. They're probably having to have a contingency. They may literally not have thought that Hezbollah would dare to strike Cyprus, as if that would take more audacity. But Nasrallah and Hezbollah have said they are not ruling out attacking first. They're not ruling out attacking the Israelis while they're mustering, while they're preparing to attack. If they get conclusive sense that Israel's going to attack, maybe they'll attack first. And they have, Nasrallah also talked about attacking, invading Israel, invading ground troops into Israel, into Galilee. And he said, maybe we will. It's still on the table. The Iraqi resistance, the Ansar Allah in Yemen, they have tens of thousands. And Yemen has hundreds of thousands of soldiers that they've said have, the only problem is they have no way to get there. And the Iraqi resistance said their main problem has been the distance. But if Israel goes to war with Lebanon, then they'll be at zero distance. They count 60,000 fighters. Yemen has been talking about how they have 300 plus thousand. So this is causing a lot of pressure on Israel. Why? It's not that there's always, since October 7th, there's been a tiny and politically, I don't want to say irrelevant, but at least small and easily dealt with block of Israelis who want a prisoner exchange, who want to get the prisoners back, even if it means giving up the option of torturing and imprisoning thousands of Palestinians. The majority of Israelis are not willing to make that trade anymore. The majority of Israelis are trying to toughen themselves. They're trying to create a new kind of Israel that is not averse to military casualties. It's not averse to civilian casualties. It's willing to see hostages killed for the sake of punishing Palestinians, for the sake of torturing and imprisoning Palestinians. That goal, genociding, is higher than preserving Israeli lives, higher than getting Israeli hostages back. They're trying to create that Zionism. They don't like, the Zionists don't like the idea of being soft and humane. They want to be tough. They want to do what needs to be done, whatever needs to be done. And it, whatever needs to be done is always genocide. That's what always needs to be done. And so the crack in Israeli society is not between the genocidal and the non-genocidal. Israeli society is, broadly speaking, genocidal, just like all of their followers outside of Israel. But the crack in Israeli society is between genocidal blocks. The followers of Meir Kahane, the Kahanist West Bank settlers, those are the tough, fanatical, not super religious. They have the trappings of being religious, but they're the real fascists, the real kind of Nazi equivalents. They're a big power block. You've heard of their Smotriches and the Ben-Gavirs. These are the people who killed, the guy who had that peace deal, Israeli. They're the people who massacred all the Palestinians in that mosque. They're those people, they're the Kahanists. Then there's the liberal Zionists, the high-tech people, the startup nation. The Air Force is mostly those kinds of people. They believe that Israel is sexy. Israel's playing on the beach. Israel is starting up computer companies and software companies. That's what Israel means to them. And then there are the religious Zionists. They're really religious, so they want to be, they want to go to Israel and they want to study the Torah. They want to do scholarship and they want to be exempted from the draft. And they've just been conclusively, I'd say, ruled, legislated, and the Supreme Court has ruled they are going to be drafted into the army. So they're not happy. The liberal Zionists want them to be drafted because they don't want to be making all the military sacrifice for this project. And the Kahanists, whatever, as long as they can keep genociding. Now, these blocs are all genocidal, but that's the only thing that they have in common. That's the unity, the hatred and contempt for everyone that isn't them, and especially Arabs. But if you have hatred as your society's glue, then you're driven ever more to hatred. You've got to do more. And it's like a drug. It really is analogous to a drug, addiction. You have to do more and more to achieve the same effect. And eventually you overdose. So like, what's the equivalent in terms of hate? You have to, the army's atrocities are the media product holding their society together. That's putting a lot of pressure on these atrocity videos. These atrocity videos have to achieve a lot. They have to substitute for actual military achievements. They have to substitute for social cohesion. They have to substitute for a political project that could offer some sustainability to their society. And if hateful atrocity propaganda is your society's glue, that makes it hard to conduct diplomacy like normal countries do, to go out there and represent, to go out there and explain your position. Look at the way the Israeli ambassador to the UN behaves. Look at the way these spokespeople go when they go on Piers Morgan's show or whatever. Look at the way they behave. Look at the way the counter protesters behave, the way that they physically assault anybody who's weaker than them or smaller than them at the first chance, whether it's on camera or not. They can't go and explain their position. They can't. Hatred is their position. Hatred and racist contempt is their position. That's who they are. That's all that they have to keep their society together. That also makes it hard to conduct strategy, to do strategic planning. They can't plan increasingly because planning involves an assessment of what you have and what your opponent has, what you can do and what your opponent can do, what you can't do and what your opponent can't do, your alliances, your resources, material resources, your weapons, your stockpiles, your military industries. You can't, if you believe that you're racially superior and your enemies are subhuman, that doesn't help with those kinds of calculations. You have to be able to put those aside. You have to be able to compartmentalize those kinds of ideas. They can't compartmentalize them. If they compartmentalize them, there's nothing left of their identity. There's no basis for cooperation. So now the religious Zionists are being drafted, but that's not gonna, the numbers of men that they can put in the field hasn't been their problem. They have more men in the field than the Palestinians have. They have more men in the field than Hezbollah has. They have the ability to field armies of hundreds of thousands of soldiers. The problem is those soldiers can't go into the underground tunnels and they can't destroy them from above and they can't fight infantry battles. They can't come out of their armored vehicles. They can't seem to keep themselves out of windows. So they're unable to defeat the Palestinian resistance in Gaza, despite having numerical and equipment advantages and unlimited backing from the US. So, but they can't explain that. They can't explain that there's some kind of military strategy and a kind of a unified strategy that the Palestinian resistance have for using their weapons and using their defensive systems that the Israelis don't have an answer for. So the only way that you can explain it from a Zionist framework is as a failure of will. That's the only thing they understand. So they look at Gaza and say, okay, it's been 9 months and the job's not done. It must be because of a failure of will. And they can't understand that their military might not just be up for the job of defeating the Palestinian resistance. Even as it's happening, they think maybe it's because Israel's being too humane. That they sincerely believe that. They sincerely believe while a genocide is going on, the Israelis who would explain why it's not over by now would explain it in terms of failure of will and of Israel being too humane. The people in the north of Israel who have been displaced by Hezbollah, they sincerely believe it's a failure of will to go and get Hezbollah. They can't understand the IDF's hesitation, the Israeli military's hesitation. They cannot understand the possibility that Israel might not be able to beat Hezbollah. So, and people like Benny Gantz, who have left the war cabinet, they're trying to ride this feeling, this confusion into power themselves. But if they were in power, they would have no more answers than Netanyahu has. So there's no answer within Israeli society. There's no one in Israeli society as it's constructed that can explain what's happening. They cannot understand what's happening. Their framework, their worldview does not allow what's happening. And it's something I wondered about. There's also something else I've wondered about that I do see happening with Israel and its supporters right now. Their structural lying, as John Elmer likes to say, their structural lying, their systematic lying about everything all the time is finally starting to have some effect on their credibility. Which also confuses them. It confuses them because they believe that if they will us to believe them, then we'll believe them. And they're not understanding why people don't believe them anymore. They don't get it. They're saying it with just as much oomph behind it as they always have. They're calling people anti-Semites with the same intensity that they always have, but no one cares about being accused of racism by genocidal people, by openly genocidal people. Nobody cares that an openly genocidal person might call them a racist. Nobody cares about that. Nobody, they lie so much that when they say horrible things, nobody believes them anymore. And that's really hard to recover. There's no trust. Zionists are not trusted. And it doesn't matter that they try to conflate that with racism while they're openly practicing the vilest form of racism. So the Israeli army, the IDF, they want to get some rest, right? They want their army to get some rest. They want to shift the war into some kind of unending series of raids and let starvation do the job. That's always been what they wanted. They wanted for Gaza. Their dream was to let starvation do most of the job and then do raids, mowing the lawn. They want to go back to mowing the lawn. That's what they used to call it. But the resistance axis, the whole axis, is not going to let that devolution take place. Instead, they keep turning temperature up. They keep turning up, some people have called it the pain dial. So that by just keeping that up, the pressure in the Red Sea, the economic blockade, the tit for tat on the northern border, the destruction of armored vehicles and infantry units and ambushes in all over Gaza, up and down Gaza. It's this pressure on the Israeli leadership that is just immense. It's immense, and it's immense, and they can't explain what's going on, and they can't relieve that pressure. Genocide in Gaza hasn't relieved that pressure on them, that psychological pressure of being able to being unable to explain in terms of their worldview what is going on. How can this be happening to us? How can we be unable to defeat our inferiors? How can we be unable to clear Hezbollah out of Lebanon? All we have to do is clear them out. Who's failing? Who is failing the strength of, who is lacking the will to do this? Why can't someone with a real willpower come and get this done? And that's why I think they're going to invade Lebanon. Even if the smart ones among them know they're going to lose, they have no other way to release the pressure they're under. I don't see any way they can release the pressure they're under. And I don't see them getting the clarity to understand the distinction between the material reality that they're facing and their will-based worldview. And I do think that they're delaying. There are military planners among them that are planning this attack, and they probably had the plan to go relying heavily on Cyprus, and now they're scratching their heads again since Nasrallah's speech. They probably didn't understand Hezbollah's targeting. They probably are now trying to adjust based on what they saw in the drone footage and what they can infer. But I actually think people have said Nasrallah doesn't bluff, right? You've probably all heard that. So like when Nasrallah says something, people have to take it seriously. But I have, to correct me if I'm wrong in the comments, I'm sure you will, but when Israel said they were going to go into Gaza and treat the people of Gaza like human animals and cut off water and cut off electricity, Israel said they were going to go and commit a genocide. They said basically they were going to commit genocide there, and they did. And in 2006 and before, they said they were going to go into Lebanon, and they did. And now they're saying they're going to go into Lebanon. I think they're going to go. I don't think they're bluffing either. And I don't know whether they were hoping Washington would stop them. When the Gaza war was getting going 8 months ago, I wondered on this channel whether they were hoping that Washington would stop them. And it became clear to me that Washington wasn't going to stop them, whatever they were hoping. And Washington said they're not going to stop this time. Washington said, you've got the green light. We're going to support you. Whatever you do in Lebanon, we're going to support you. So that's not going to stop them. They probably wanted to bomb the airport. They signaled that, right? They signaled that they wanted to bomb the airport. They made that, they planted that story in the Telegraph and about how there's weapons at the civilian airport so that they could, there's only one reason to do that kind of story. It's to prepare people for bombing the airport. But while they're probably reworking their plans, I think their plans are to invade. And in a little while, not very long, they're going to settle on a plan, even if it's a bad one. And they might even have some surprises. They're certainly going to commit some spectacular atrocities. But what we're seeing now, what we're going to see, is just more rolling, deeper attacks by Israel into Lebanon and deeper attacks into Israel by Hezbollah in response. And they're going to start mustering, and they're going to get attacked as they're mustering, and they're going to come up with some plan, and they're going to throw themselves onto Hezbollah's prepared defenses, and Hezbollah will launch exactly the war with no ceiling that they've promised. And this is all going to happen because Israel cannot relieve the pressure coming from the dissonance between their belief that their will can solve all of their problems and the material reality of the situation they're in. I'm going to stop there for tonight. Hang in there. Hang in there. And check out the live stream tomorrow, day 264 on Electronic Intifada. And we will we'll see you in the next one. We're back now, so you can expect the regular sit reps from here on out.
Israeli Defense Minister Yoav Gallant has arrived in Washington, D.C., where he's expected to meet with Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin, Secretary of State Antony Blinken, and others. They're expected to discuss the situation in Gaza as well as Lebanon, where fear is growing that fighting between Israel and Hezbollah could escalate. On Sunday, Netanyahu said the Israeli military will soon shift its focus to Lebanon. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres spoke Friday.
The risk for the conflict in the Middle East to widen is real and must be avoided. One rash move, one miscalculation, could trigger a catastrophe that goes far beyond the border and, frankly, beyond imagination. Let's be clear. The people of the region and the people of the world cannot afford Lebanon to become another Gaza.
For more, we're joined by Rami Khoury, Palestinian-American journalist, senior public policy fellow at the American University of Beirut. He's also a non-resident senior fellow at the Arab Center, Washington. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Rami. So can you explain what exactly Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu means when he says they are finishing up their operations in Gaza and shifting to Lebanon to take on Hezbollah?
It means that he's really trying to find a new political format that he can present to the 7-8 different political audiences that he is addressing simultaneously in Israel, in the United States, in Palestine, and all around the world. Netanyahu is above all a multi-talented political entertainer, but he's a successful one. He's been the longest-serving prime minister, I think, ever in Israel. And he does it by constantly juggling different audiences. But he's got himself into a corner now. And the pronouncement he made about the Gaza fighting is almost over, we're going to shift to Lebanon now, you can't take that at face value. It just is a kind of a notional idea that Hezbollah and Lebanon are important. We've got to pay attention to them. They always have since the last 18 years they've done that. But the Gaza situation is not over. The political contest, the military contest, and the contest of wills is not over, because it's not only manifested in Gaza. The Gaza, Hamas, Palestine versus Israel conflict, or versus Israel and the U.S., because they're really a joint team, the U.S. and Israel, in carrying out this genocidal attack. That contest is expressed in politics within the United States, electoral coalitions, public activism, legal cases, and so many arenas now around the world. And inside Israel, you have 5 or 6 different constituencies that are battling to get Netanyahu to pursue policies that they like, whether it's to release the hostages, end the war, find a peace agreement one day, whatever. So this is what he's doing. He's just juggling all of these different constituencies. And he can't really do it anymore, because he's been exposed. The weaknesses of Israel have been exposed. The weaknesses of the Israeli-American military alliance and diplomatic tandem have been badly exposed as ineffective. Anywhere the U.S. and Israel have worked together militarily, diplomatically, and politically in the last few years, whether it's in Palestine or in Lebanon or elsewhere, they have really not achieved their strategic goals. And this is probably just an inevitability had to happen at some point when Israel could no longer conduct its policies as it has for almost a century since Zionism started in 1917 until now. For a century, Israel has done very well in convincing the world that it is a moral force, it needs to be protected, etc., and it has succeeded. But it's done that by camouflaging the realities of what it does and denying the Palestinians a voice in the global political sphere. Those periods are over, and now the Palestinians are speaking out everywhere. There are political activism efforts with partners all over the world, legal groups, political groups, student groups, union groups, church groups, Jewish progressive groups. So this is where Netanyahu is trying to juggle the different balls that he's got to keep in the air at the same time. And it's extraordinary that his own military command is at odds with him. His own coalition partners are at odds with him. And the U.S., his biggest supporter, is at odds with him. So we have to not take what Netanyahu says at face value, but understand it as a reflection of his self-produced painting himself into a corner. And what the Israelis usually do in a situation like this is they talk about anti-Semitism, the Holocaust, the people who want to kill Jews all over the world, evil people in the Arab region, whether it's, you know, used to be Saddam Hussein or ISIS, or now it's Hamas, and they keep finding evil people. And they talk, and then they do military action. They're very good at destroying things with their military force. They're very bad at resolving the political underlying tensions that give rise to the militarism. And Lebanon is also now an unprecedented new situation where the technical capabilities that Hezbollah has shown over the last 3-4 years, it's shown what it can do technically, militarily, but in the last 4 or 5 days, by releasing these videos of its surveillance drones and things like that, it is showing that the Lebanon-Israel border is more dangerous than ever because of the capabilities that Hezbollah has. If there were to be a full-scale war, which I still doubt, I think there's going to be limited skirmishes along the border. But the consequences of a full-scale war would be just devastating for power plants, even the airports or whatever ports. And Hezbollah showed aerial photos of the gas extraction positions that Israel has in the Eastern Mediterranean. And so the message it's sending is you don't want to get into a full-scale war with us, to the Israelis. And so we have to just really see how this plays out. Not surprisingly, the Americans have taken the diplomatic lead and have not succeeded.
Rami, if you can talk more about this video, which Hezbollah titled "To Whom It May Concern." They released it on June 22nd, featuring coordinates of sensitive and vital Israeli targets that would be struck in the event of a war against Lebanon, marking the second such warning within less than a week. The video beginning with a clip from Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah, where he warns the Lebanese resistance will fight without limits, rules, or restraints if Israel wages a war against Lebanon. The video beginning with a clip. The video begins with a clip of Nasrallah. The targets, as you said, including sensitive targets in Haifa, in Ashdod, the Hadera power station, The Ramat David military airport, the Ben-Gurion airport, as well as the Dimona nuclear reactor. Talk more about the significance of this and why you think actually it will not come to this.
Well, there are several really significant things about this. First of all, it shows the technical capabilities that Hezbollah has of evading the Israeli-American very sophisticated defensive system and getting through, taking photographs and coming back. Second of all, it's important because it clarifies to the Israelis and the Americans, who are really their partners in Middle East warfare and aggression, it clarifies to them that the consequences of a war are not going to be defined only by what Israel decides to do. Historically, Israel was more powerful, whether it's with Hezbollah or Hamas or somebody else, and it could start and end the war whenever it wanted. That's no longer the case, as we see in Gaza. And third of all, I think the third and most important message is the fact that the strategic balance between not just Hezbollah and Israel, but between all of the forces in the region that are close to Hezbollah, close to Iran, close to Hamas, close to the vast majority of Arab citizens, probably 80, 90% of Arab citizens around the region, are sympathetic to what Hezbollah and Hamas are doing in resisting Israel. The message is that this power that they have generated, technological and military power, is now on display, and the Israelis should take it seriously, which also tells us, should tell the Israelis and the Americans, if they're listening, but they tend to listen but really not understand what's being said. The message is that if Hezbollah has these capabilities, you can be pretty sure that its friends and allies all around the region have either the same or something similar, and or Iran will come and help them develop it soon, or Hezbollah will help them develop it soon. So we passed, about 2 years ago, we passed the point where Israel and the U.S. dominated the strategic realities, military realities in the Middle East, certainly in the Levant area. And now there's this uncertain picture, and the Israelis have learned huge lessons, or should have learned, in Gaza, of what they can and cannot do militarily. The Americans are still trying to figure this out. And Lebanon is now the next immediate cause of concern, but it's not so immediate only because Netanyahu said we're looking at Lebanon now. It's because for the last 10 years, the Israelis have repeatedly said that Hezbollah is their main strategic concern in the region. Hamas, they always thought they could contain or destroy or whatever. But
we have 30
Hezbollah
seconds, Rami.
Hezbollah is much more formidable, and the Israelis have always realized that, and therefore they're now trying to focus on it, but with nothing new to deal with the new realities, and this is one of the great dilemmas that all of us have to deal with.
Oh, for WPFW News in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin. Today is Wednesday, June 26th. Here are some headlines. The U.S. Supreme Court today ruled in favor of the Biden administration in a legal spat with GOP-led states over government powers to combat misinformation on social media. In a 6-3 decision, justices said GOP states suing the Biden administration had no standing, tossing out lower court rulings in favor of the states. GOP officials argued White House staffers and federal agencies applied unrelenting pressure on social media platforms to suppress conservative viewpoints. The White House denied the accusation and said a ruling in favor of the Republican states would limit the government's ability to combat hate speech and engage with social media platforms on matters of national security, public health, and election integrity. Conservative justices Samuel Alito, Neil Gorsuch, and Clarence Thomas dissented. In state news, House Representative Jamal Bowman of New York lost his primary election yesterday in a race that highlighted the divisions among Democrats on Israel's war with Hamas. Bowman, who called for a ceasefire days after Hamas's October 7 attack inside Israel and has accused Israel of committing genocide in Gaza, lost to George Latimer, a pro-Israel centrist. The American-Israel Public Affairs Committee's Super PAC, United Democracy Project, poured a record $14.5 million into defeating Bowman, the most a single group has ever spent on a House race. Bowman, a prominent member of the Progressive Squad, is the first member of Congress to lose their primary to a non-incumbent challenger this cycle. And the Council of the District of Columbia gave final approval to the city's fiscal 2025 budget yesterday, and among the provisions was funding to create a task force for a study of reparations for Black residents. The bill to create a task force was introduced by Councilman Kenyon McDuffie last year and has yet to be passed, but the inclusion of preliminary funding is a vote of confidence toward its passage. Under McDuffie's proposal, the task force would explore ways to deliver restitution to Black residents harmed by generations of racism and institutional discrimination, starting with slavery, in a city that has some of the starkest racial wealth disparities in the nation. In international news, Kenyan President William Ruto withdrew his support for a planned tax hike a day after the bill was passed by the country's legislature, responding to intense protests against the tax hike. Protesters yesterday stormed the Kenyan Parliament building, setting a portion of it on fire, and held demonstrations in major cities across the country. At least 23 people were killed and scores wounded, according to medical workers. Police fired live ammunition and tear gas at protesters in the capital, Nairobi. President Ruto is facing competing pressures from protesters and international lenders, including the IMF, which are urging deficit reductions in exchange for loans. And in weather today, in New York City, it is 89 degrees under partly cloudy skies. In Washington, D.C., it is 96 degrees and partly cloudy. Both cities are forecast for severe weather this evening. For WPFW News in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin.